David Johnson from the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and about Crossroads. I have no idea what number of frameworks this is for 2017, but we've done several. This is a really important session today. When we started by Crossroads back in 2000, well, officially in 2004, one of the very first things that my colleague Ann Shane at the time got involved in, working a lot with our friends at Lilly Endowment, was the whole issue of STEM education. And somebody once said, well, I thought about Crossroads was really a life sciences initiative about startup companies and venture capital and investment, so education is important, but why is about Crossroads involved in it? And I said, well, the answer is, has actually been asked to us by one of our stakeholders, who said, what good does it do to try to be creating opportunities in the economy, jobs in the economy, and a future for the economy, if our children are not prepared to be able to take those jobs and opportunities to be able to do them? And really, the issues we're going to talk about today are a counterpart to that theme and represent also an increasing direction for BioCrossroads, because in the healthcare field, what good does it do for us to have spent, as we have, the last 4 or 5 years creating the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, which is a wonderful work in progress, with a focus on metabolic disease and obesity, if we are not using that asset that we are creating to try to do something about the epidemic diseases of obesity and diabetes that we have right here in the state of Indiana? And the stakeholders involved in BioCrossroads and the Biosciences Research Institute and the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership increasingly get and want us to address the convergence of these issues and, frankly, the talented people who are dealing with them to try to do something about them. What you're going to hear from today are three incredibly talented leaders, each of whom are actually running other institutions, but have decided that both those institutions and they personally and professionally have a need to come together and address some of the most important and most compelling public health, population health, and frankly economic issues that we are facing here in our community. And many are across the United States, but we seem to have an outsized share of our challenges when it comes to our healthcare statistics. And especially for those of you who are employers, one of the messages that we hope you take away today is these numbers are so bad that if things are not done about them along the lines of what we're going to be talking about this morning, and other people don't join in trying to begin to address all of this as we have the information and the tools to do so, our economic progress will be limited by our poor health. Our ability to continue to advance will be really restricted by the fact that we will not have the productive employees and the activity in the economy to be able to make it happen. So it's not only a social imperative, it's not only a moral imperative, it's an economic imperative to deal with the issues that we're going to talk about this morning. And again, you're going to hear about that from three people who are passionate, who are visionary, and who are incredibly well-informed about both what the challenges are. You're going to hear a lot about that. You're going to see some really, really stunning information, but also can move beyond that information to begin to work with everybody, starting with this audience here, but with many audiences that they're dealing with across the state, to begin to think about ways to address those challenges. Because the good news is they have picked targets that really are capable of being addressed if we simply have the will, the resources, and the focus to do so. And you're going to hear about that this morning. So thank you very much for being here. I want to thank our sponsors, Miles Printing, who I think have brought every single framework that we've done, at least in my memory, and that's quite a few. And so I want to go ahead and introduce our first speaker this morning, who will give you some really interesting information, Dr. Paul Halverson, who is the founding dean and the professor at the IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health here in Indianapolis. Paul made a similar version of the presentation he's about to make to you, to our Central Indiana Corporate Partnership meeting in December, and it's the only time at a CICP meeting I've heard people gasp. So, Paul, take it away.
Thanks, David. So it's great to be here, and I'm hoping today to create a context for the conversation, because frequently we talk about health and we talk about economics, and sometimes they don't seem to go together, and I hope that what I can do is to build a bridge between these things. So So first let me talk about the fact that we haven't always been as bad as we are. Isn't that good news? So we're 39th. If we look at our overall health ranking in the United States, Indiana ranks 39th. Now, that's actually good news because for 4 years in a row, we were 41st. In fact, when I first came to Indiana, we bought these little buttons because we were celebrating, I think it was Anti-Hypertension Week or something like that, and we said, we're done with 41, because I thought, certainly we can't just stay at 41. Well, we did. For 4 years, we didn't have to buy any new buttons. It was horrible, actually. So this last year, we actually made a little bit of an improvement. We're ranked at 39th. But if you look back, and I know the monitors are kind of hard to see, there was a time back in, I think it was 91, where we were ranked 26th. So just a little bit worse than average. But over time, it has gotten progressively worse. Now we're beginning to see a little bit of glimmer of hope. We're down to 39th. But I think it's important to recognize how all of these things fit together. And in part, we're in that last quintile. If we look at, for example, public health funding, that's the amount of money that we as a society, government, state, local, contribute to supporting public health in our state. There's only one other state that's worse than we are in terms of our per capita funding. So a lot of times we say, you know, what we budget, where we put our money tells us what we value. And obviously in Indiana, we don't value our health real well. Air pollution is something you may be surprised at. We're ranked 47th in the country when it comes to air pollution. And people look out and they say, well, you know, it's not that bad. Well, if you look down in the southwest part of our state, and you look at our coal-fired power plants, and I know coal is an important issue, but it also is an important pollutant. And if we look at kids with asthma, adults with COPD, and a whole host of other respiratory diseases, you'll see the toll that air pollution takes in our state. Also, if we look at any number of things, we're in the last quartile as it relates to cancer deaths. We're 42nd in cancer deaths. I was just talking with Brian, who's one of my great partners, and you'll hear from him in a moment. He runs one of the largest healthcare systems in our state, and he just opened a new cancer center, much to his chagrin. Right? We're building cancer centers because we're this bad in cancer. Not that we don't know how to treat it, but that we have such a strong prevalence of cancer that we have to treat it. If we look at premature death, we're in the fourth quintile. And if you look at smoking, we're now 39th. That actually has improved a little bit. But if you think about where 39th is compared to the other states, it's substantially worse. So you can see we're in a number of these areas, we're substantially worse than other states. Which doesn't make sense if you think about where we're at as an economic development, right? We focus on being first. We have incredible life sciences development, terrific recruitment of companies and brilliant scientists and all kinds of economic development, and yet our health is just completely disconnected, it seems, from that. We're also in the fourth quintile in terms of obesity and drug deaths. And again, now I should point out, because my colleague Dr. Williams from the dental school says, you always make it seem terrible that dentists are the cause of our problem. Well, no, we're not bad because we have dentists. We're bad because we don't have enough dentists. So if you look at where we stay at, compare on the Gallup, there's a new Gallup Wellness Index, and actually on the Gallup Index, we're getting worse, not better. We're right after Arkansas. We're at 47th and right before Oklahoma, Kentucky, and West Virginia. So we were 46th last year, and we're getting worse. And if you look at the top states, Hawaii, Alaska, South Dakota, Maine, and those are the states that actually sit in that top category. And the last states, actually, again, we've talked about that. if we look at what are the things that really drive these poor ratings, and I know this is hard to see, so let me just go to the punchline. If you look at smoking and air pollution, they're the two largest areas where we have the greatest impact on poor health. If you look at smoking, that is the leading cause of preventable death in our state, and we know how to fix it. And that's, I think, the important message. 75% of the funding that we spend in health actually goes to treating preventable chronic diseases. So again, if we look at how are we spending our money, and we're spending our money at record rates for health, and there's a lot of conversation now around some of the drivers related to cost. The biggest driver of cost is the disease that we're treating. And it, in Indiana, it's substantially higher in terms of overall prevalence. If we look at 80% of our cardiovascular disease is for the most part preventable. And again, this is directly related to tobacco and a whole host of other behavioral related indicators. Less than 3% of our national spending actually goes into prevention in public health. So it's an important thing. You've heard the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We're not getting our ounce, and that's part of the problem. So one of the things that I know that we talk about as Hoosiers is, you know, we don't want to stand out too much. So I thought to myself, well, what if we said we were average? What would it be to be average? And it would be a lot less money that we would spend in health. In fact, if you look just at preventable hospitalizations, that's over $1.5 billion in avoidable costs just if we could get to average. If we were at average in tobacco, it would save us just in health costs $333 million. So again, there's a substantial cost to being below average, which is where we're at. So it's important also to recognize that we don't all suffer equally. And those of us in Indianapolis, perhaps we think about Indianapolis as one large city, and it is. But you can see from this map at the top, 83.7, that's the life expectancy of people that live in Hamilton County. And if you live in Hamilton County, congratulations. You're pretty close to the life expectancy in Japan or Switzerland, which are that the highest life expectancy in the world. However, if you live in other parts of Indianapolis, and you can see in southern Indianapolis, in fact, pretty close to where we're standing right now, is at 69.4, which is similar to the life expectancy in Bangladesh or Uzbekistan. And that's, again, 28 miles apart and 14 years in difference in life expectancy. So we don't all suffer equally, and probably the greatest indicator of your health is your zip code, believe it or not. And frankly, there's a lot that gets packed into that, and part of that is all about health behaviors and access and a whole host of other things. So this just goes to show you the substantial difference if you look at the life expectancy between countries and between cities and so forth. So tobacco is our single greatest challenge as it relates to preventable death in our state. It actually causes 9 out of 10 deaths from lung cancer and a whole host of other things. It's frequently said, and I endorse that, that tobacco makes every disease worse. And in fact, it complicates many of the things that we perhaps don't even draw correlations to. But it's amazing in terms of its negative impact on us. If we look at our costs, and this is an important thing, it relates to a report that we released as it relates to a commission report that we did for the Fairbanks Foundation. About $6 billion a year is spent in Indiana, both in our health costs and our related productivity losses. So that's money that's not going to the bottom line. It's money that we're spending that is, for the most part, very avoidable. And the other thing that's important here in this slide is to suggest to you, to remind you, that for every pack of cigarettes we sell in Indiana, it's $15.90 per pack in costs, right? So we're not selling tobacco at $15.90 per pack. We're selling it at around $6 the last time I checked. And I admit I don't smoke, so it's hard to know exactly what it is. But the reality is we are selling it for far less than it's costing us in terms of our societal costs. And for those of you who pay health care bills, you're paying for it in a substantial way. But also in the issues related to productivity loss, we know substantial productivity loss related to tobacco users. So what you might find it interesting to know that the single greatest way in which to reduce tobacco use is to raise the price of the product. This is not about money, actually. This is not about we need more tax money. This is about the fact that when you raise the price, fewer people will buy the product. That it is the single greatest way in which to reduce smoking prevalence in our state. And it's not just Indiana. That's true across the country. And the people that benefit the most are the people actually who are the poorest and who also are our young people. If we can raise the price significantly enough, we can actually substantially reduce, and this actually shows as we raise the price, the actual use of tobacco goes down. So we have seen some improvement in our smoking rates in Indiana, but nothing will change it as much as price will. And again, it has to be a substantial price increase, and you might ask why that is. Well, first of all, tobacco companies, it's estimated, spend $280 million a year in Indiana in marketing. And if you look at their marketing costs, a substantial amount of that marketing goes into price rebate. So if you increase the price of the product, let's say, by 40 cents or 60 cents, it's been known that tobacco companies can easily offset that increase in price by sending targeted coupons to people who smoke to be able to reduce that cost so that it essentially blunts the impact of a smaller increase. So that's why a substantial increase is necessary to have the impact on smoking. So this just goes to show you the fact that there are people that will say, this is a terrible idea. Raising the price on poor people is just awful. And they're not going to benefit. Well, the reality is in the yellow line, you can see the benefit. And to the far left, and I'm sorry, you can't see this real well. These are the people that are below poverty, okay? The below poverty people actually saw almost half of the benefit of the tax, which means they quit smoking or greatly reduced smoking as a result of the tax increase. But if you look at the green line, that's the percentage of the tax that they actually paid. So the people that pay the greater tax, so if this is actually taken from the dollar increase in federal tax, the people that paid the greatest share of the tax increase were people at two times or greater of poverty level. So those people that had the money, frankly, it didn't matter as much to them what the cost was. They continued to smoke anyway. They didn't get nearly the benefit because for them it was irritating that the costs were higher, but they just continued to smoke. The people on the far left, those people that are make less money actually, that had a substantial enough impact that it reduced or eliminated smoking as a habit. Now, the important thing also is to recognize ethically, if we raise the price but don't allow or provide people the opportunity with help to stop, I think we have an ethical issue, right? So one of the things that we recognize is in Indiana we get over $300 million a year for the tobacco settlement that Indiana reached with the tobacco companies over smoking. less than $5 million actually goes to tobacco prevention and control. So part of what we need to do is, if we raise the price, and I hope we do, we also need to be able to provide opportunities for people to quit. And we know there are science-based ways in which to help people quit. Quitting cold turkey is not a great idea, and it's not very effective. But there are ways in which we can help people do it. It's very cost-effective, but it costs some money. And I'm almost done. So the other issue I want to just briefly talk about is opioid addiction, overdoses. If we look at overdose deaths, Indiana, like most states, actually, we have more people dying of overdose than traffic crashes. And this number is frankly a runaway train. I'll show you some very recent modeling within the last few days that has been done, and it's very alarming. So as we look at, this is drug poisoning deaths per year, and in fact, it's very difficult to actually pinpoint it to a specific drug, in large part because our death investigation system is a coroner-based system here in Indiana. Maybe you don't know that, but it's been estimated that frankly, those states like ours may have 20 to 40% greater number of people dying that we just haven't even recorded properly. So there is a substantial issue as it relates to overdoses. You may also find it interesting to know that this is not just an issue with young people. This is an age distribution, and this basically shows you here are the young people at 10 to 19. Here's the 20 to 29-year-olds. It's actually the 30 to 39-year-olds, 40 to 49-year-olds. You know, the reality is the prototypical overdose death is an older white male. So this is not a young person's disease. And frankly, it is one of the things that's hitting hard the middle class, white people that are succumbing to overdose deaths. Does that mean that they're the only ones? No, not at all. But I think we have in our mind that this is simply this is something that happens to those people that we don't know. And the reality is we do know them, and we know them pretty well. So this is our actual overdose deaths from 1979 to 2015, and you can see the substantial increase. And here is the projections through 2020. It's roughly at a rate of almost 9% per year increase, and this is very consistent with the rest of the country. This is, again, it's hard for you to see. These are all of our, these are the most substantial counties with overdose deaths. This line in the red is Marion County. And so you can see the substantial increase that we anticipate in overdose deaths in Indiana. We're not the highest state in the country in terms of our overdose deaths that we know of. Remember, I said we're 20 to 40% underreported. We fit in this category here with Mississippi, Arkansas, Michigan, and Louisiana, next to the last category. So I'll just leave you with this slide. There's been a lot of important research that's been done that actually links health and wealth. Good income and high income and good health. For whatever the reason, we seem to have not created or understood this association in Indiana. It's been a long-standing. There's been a lot of good research in this area, but what we do know about, if we study very prosperous economies and if we look at countries and states that have been very successful, there have also been those that have done a good job in improving and increasing their healthiness. And so at the end of the day, what we all need to be about are finding ways in which to improve our healthiness and our well-being so we can enjoy our life and the economic prosperity. So I'm going to stop and thank you for your attention, and we'll look forward to questions at the end. David?
Thank you, Paul. In case you missed it, the Gap-worthy slide of the many he had, there's that map of the 28 miles and the 28 years, or the 14 miles and 28 years. Our next speaker will take the conversation further, and that's our great friend and colleague, Claire Fidian Green, who's the president and CEO of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation.
Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Right.
So Paul gets you feeling depressed, and then my job and Brian's job is to talk to you about things that we can do together to combat both the tobacco and opioid epidemic. So I'm going to talk to you today about what employers, and I think all of you are in a position to represent an employer and can take steps to try to help combat the epidemic for your employees. So let me first start with an overview of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation for those of you who don't know us. Our mission is to advance the vitality of Indianapolis and the well-being of its people, and we do that by focusing on our city's greatest opportunities and challenges. And we have three issue areas. We focus on education, tobacco and opioid addiction, and the life sciences. We do our work through strategic grant making, through evidence-based advocacy, and then through cross-sector convenience and collaboration. Paul has better eyes in the back of his head than I do, so I'm going to use my slides here so I can see a little bit more. So the focus of today's discussion, I wanted to talk with you about what employers can do to tackle both tobacco and opioids. The good news is there are evidence-based steps that can be taken. And I also want to talk a little bit about the roles that employers can take with prevention. It would be awfully nice if we didn't have to help people who are addicted, but actually prevent them getting addicted in the first place. So let's start with tobacco. So as Paul mentioned earlier, we know that there is a significant economic impact on our state when it comes to tobacco. And in terms of employers, smokers actually cost $6,000 more than non-smokers. So the data are pretty stark, and that cost is higher absenteeism, higher healthcare costs, and lower productivity. The Fairbanks Foundation actually just released a new report last week looking at the Medicaid population in Indiana, and we found that the same principle carried through, and in fact, the total cost for the most recent fiscal year, which was July 2015 to June 2016, smokers on Medicaid cost over $500 million more than non-smokers on Medicaid, so $540 million, half a billion dollars. That's just for 1 year. So we know that smokers cost more because they have more illnesses that require health care costs. So what can employers do about tobacco? As Paul said earlier, we actually know what to do. There's a whole host of, a whole body of evidence and research, and health and business experts recommend three things that employers can do. The first is make sure you're providing adequate insurance coverage that actually helps people who are smokers quit successfully. The second is to offer financial incentives for your employees that encourages them to quit. And then the third is to make sure you actually have strong smoke tobacco-free policies and you're implementing and enforcing them. So let me go into a little more detail on each of those. What does adequate insurance mean? The CDC and the National Business Group in Health say that you should make sure you're screening for tobacco with every clinical encounter, that you're actually providing the full range of counseling for tobacco cessation and all approved, FDA-approved tobacco cessation medications. And then at least 2 quit attempts a year are covered. We know that it often takes smokers 10 or 11 attempts before they successfully quit. Financial incentives for quitting. This is pretty interesting. This could be cash prizes, it could be reductions in your healthcare premiums, it could be extra contributions to your HSA account. We looked at a recent example from General Electric. They piloted providing employees $100 to attempt quitting and then $650 if they successfully quit for 12 months. And the ROI from that study, they found that there was a 3 times greater likelihood of success with that incentive than without an incentive. So based off of the pilot's results, they are now scaling that across their company. And then finally, smoke-free policies. We actually do have a smoke-free law in Indiana, but it has a number of loopholes. Some cities have very strong ordinances, including Marion County and South Bend, just recently implemented a new smoke-free ban that's more extensive than the state law. But there are some things that could be done. So colleges and universities right now Only 20 in Indiana actually have smoke-free campuses, and there are still places on campuses where you can smoke. And ideally, you would have a completely smoke- and tobacco-free campus. The second is bars and restaurants, which is part of the loophole that I mentioned in our state's law. An employer can make the decision to go smoke-free, and that would be better for not only their employees, of course, but their customers. And then finally, if you do have a smoke-free policy, making sure it's enforced. I'm sure we've all walked by the group of smokers standing right outside of the building's doorway, making sure that there is that perimeter where it's a smoke-free area and you're going as far as your parking lot, every part of your property, and making sure that folks are not smoking. Okay, turning now to opioids. Paul also mentioned this. Opioids also cost employers money. So Paul said that drug overdoses surpassed motor vehicle crashes as the cause of death, and 80% of Indian employers recently surveyed said that opioid addiction was a problem amongst their employees. So that cost manifests itself in higher risk of injury, illnesses, absenteeism from work, lower productivity, and, of course, higher healthcare costs. Not to mention trying to hire new employees who can't pass drug screening tests. So it is a significant problem. So what can employers do? The National Safety Council recommends three approaches: providing educations on opioids to employees, knowing what the risks are, how do you detect that somebody is struggling with substance abuse, and actually routinely explaining that as part of your wellness program in your workplace. Expanding your drug testing panel if you provide one now. 90% of employers in Indiana actually do screen for drugs, but only half test for prescription opioids. And then making sure that you're providing access to treatment. The most recent data show it is an ROI of $6 to $7 for every dollar spent on an employee assistance program. And then prevention. Last year, the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation released a report that we commissioned from Paul and his colleagues at the Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. And in that report, they looked at the opioid epidemic and steps that we can take to combat it. There were three recommendations. One, focus on prevention. Two, expand access to harm reduction services like needle exchange or the life-saving drug naloxone if you've overdosed. And then the third was to grow the supply of capacity for those providing addiction treatment services. So talking for a moment about prevention, many employers have partnerships either through their corporate giving programs or employee volunteer programs with K-12 schools or with colleges and universities when it comes to recruiting. It would be wonderful to think about creative ways to leverage that relationship through either your employees or your own giving programs and volunteer programs to encourage and support schools in auditing the programs that they're providing in a K-12 and higher ed setting. We know from the report that I just mentioned from the School of Public Health that schools are often creating their own homegrown program, or they're using programs like DARE, which has a great brand name but is actually proven not to be effective. But there are evidence-based programs. Our staff did a recent review of the literature from the U.S. Surgeon General's report and SAMHSA and identified five top evidence-based programs. The number one program is called Life Skills that covers tobacco, alcohol, and also opioids. And these slides will be provided to you afterwards. I provided a link with more information about that as well as some additional resources. So I would encourage you, if you are in a position to do this, is to find a way to use the relationships you have with schools, universities, and colleges to find a way to ensure we're doing a much better job with prevention. And that is the end of my presentation to talk about what employers can do, and I will turn it over now to Brian.
Okay. Good touch. Here you go. I'm done. That was my trick for the day. My name is Brian Mills, and I'm the president and CEO of the Community Health Network, and I get the pleasure of hanging out with really smart people, and you learn things by doing that. And it's really cool to hang around with Paul and Claire and understand what's going on. And then it's kind of the story of my career. You try to figure out, why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? And I run a health system. I've been with the Community Health Network for more than three decades. I never set out to be in healthcare. I'm a bean counter. I have stumbled into the Community Health Network years ago. That's a totally different story. And I have a job I never applied for, so I'm the president, CEO, and they asked me to do that, and I said, I don't think I'd be very good at that. But here I am. And then you go through all this stuff and you say, what's the real purpose of these things? So I was asked to become the chair of the Indiana Hospital Association about 18 months ago. And literally the day before I accepted that position, dang, Paul sent out one of those reports showing how bad our health was. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, I think this is purpose. I think this is why. And then you start reading through that information. My father died of heart disease. He was a smoker. My mom is battling with lung cancer. She's a smoker. I mean, smoker since, 14 years old. We're from the rural Kentucky. So Indiana is better than Kentucky on all these things. We have moved up. I have a sibling who I've determined, I didn't diagnose, but I really was determined that she had an opioid addiction and got her to someplace and taken care of. Now, to see that firsthand, my sister is who it is, and she'd be one of my heroes in my life because she spent 40 years as a special ed teacher. And, to have that passion and then all of a sudden being a sit, and I finally got her there because I realized that she was compromising her kids. And that got us to take the trip. We have a lot of behavioral care and addiction services at community, that family members in crisis programs. Had a nephew who took his life by suicide. So you say, okay, now I know why. And I don't think we're atypical. I mean, maybe from that you figure we're just a mess, but I don't think we are. I think we're very typical. I think we put facades on, and we all say, hey, everything's fine. And then you start looking at this information, and you say, okay, what is this? And you get put in positions in your life to do something about it. And I said, okay, you want me to be the head of this hospital association? I'll do that, but I need to challenge you. I need to challenge my colleagues. I challenged and said, I want you to do something tonight that I, or consider doing something tonight that I've always done. When that stuff comes out, you just look at your shoes, let it blow over, don't take any responsibility, there'll be another story tomorrow. And I just said, can we lock arms and do something about that? And I was so overwhelmingly shocked that night, between that night and 2 days later, I had heard from virtually every CEO of every health hospital or health system in the state saying, I'm in. And then from there, I called Julie Reed at the State Medical Society. She instantaneously said, I'm in. I called Kevin Brenninger at the Indiana Chamber and said, can we have lunch? Want to talk about this? And he said, I'm in. I called Rob Hillman at Anthem in. Talked to Claire, talked to Paul. And with that, it just keeps growing. So we've used these forums like this to have an opportunity to talk to people because if you're in this room, you're in a position of influence. And every other place I go, people have influence. The question is, do you have the courage to use it? And there's a lot of people, who have all – and first of all, I should say, I'm not very political. That's not something I'm very good at, but one of my mentors told me after I accepted the position to run this health system, you dang well better figure out how this works because your organization you're responsible for is very regulated. So you better know what's going on at the state, the local level, the state level, and the federal level. So, I can listen and take advice, and so I do get involved in these things. But get involved for a purpose. And the purpose is health. Yeah, we've got a tax bill down there. I'll talk a little bit more about it, but this isn't about money. We've been asked many times, what do you think we're going to do with money? And I said, well, give us a little bit for smoking cessation, as Paul talks about. The rest of it, I don't care. That's your responsibility. We're trying to improve the health of our citizens. So, I've got a few slides I'll run through here. They're not very readable, but the purpose is I was hoping to tempt you to go onto our website and we're at Alliance for a Healthier Indiana or healthierindiana.org, either one. We've got all kinds of information there. And as Paul and Claire said, when we started looking at this data, it's a big stuff. Infant mortality, obesity. Those are big societal issues that we have to deal with. The opioids is unbelievably complex. Unbelievable. And Paul's correct. I mean, it's those people. They go to those places. You know, stay out of those places. Don't go to the crack house. Look at who you're hanging out with. That's not what it's about. I mean, the other side of this is so sophisticated, and the business knowledge of the people distributing this is brilliant. It really is. I hate to say that. That's kind of a praise. It's brilliant. Where'd they go? They went after money. They went after people with money. They went every high school in this state, I guarantee you, I don't care public, private, where it's located, it has an opioid problem. It has a heroin problem. I guarantee you. It does. Matter of fact, my 28-year-old son, we have four sons, so he's our second oldest. Last year he lost his third classmate to overdose. Third. These are kids that I've known since they were in kindergarten. These are good kids from good families. Nobody was ever set out to do this. And the most recent one happened in our neighborhood, and of all people, is Dad Bounty. Since those stories, those aren't those people, those aren't anyplace else. I got to believe you have stories as well. And so you say, we're going to try to change this. And in the part of this, you tick people off, and that's never my purpose. But the thing we've got to do is we've got to say, how do you start? And this alliance, and we've gone and talked to people, and people say, yeah, I'm behind you. We've got to have a victory. And we believe that our victory needed to start with smoking and the rate of smoking. And we came out with a plan last year, four-part plan. One was DOA really quick, but we're going to get that one. And the DOA real quick was this one. If you want to change smoking, you really want to change this? You really want to stop it? It's really simple. Raise the legal age to 21. Really simple. 95% of all smokers started before they were 18, before they were 21. Vast majority before they were 18. It's an addiction. It's an addiction like any other addiction. The brain's not, you know, people that understand brains a lot better than I believe tell me about the development of the brain. And until you're 25, especially if you're male, you're just going to make stupid decisions because we can tell, what were you thinking? They weren't thinking. Tomorrow, still not thinking. I got four of those idiots I've raised, you know, so I'm now a seasoned veteran. So all these things are related there. So that tobacco 21, is something that we're going to keep pushing on because that's the key. And the marketing that Paul's talking about, that's what it's at. It's to make sure, and if we can ever separate that gap, we'll change this dramatically. The second thing was we asked for $1.50. You know, $1 is passed by the House. The Senate says zero. We're still saying $1.50. I'd sent out a email to my top 1,000 leaders yesterday and said, here's what we're doing. You know what we're doing. We've talked about it. Here's a list of your representatives. Call them. Tell us who you're calling. We want to know how many calls we've made, who you've made them to, and I'm going to ask everybody else to do the same thing. And they're really easy calls. You never talk to anybody. You know, you're talking to a voicemail typically, maybe an assistant or an aide, but they count those. Those mean something, and so we're flooding them. And we're going to continue to ask people to do the same thing. Because we want to modify this. So the other two parts of this was we asked for additional dollars for cessation. We asked for a number that really wasn't as much as what we wanted, but we wanted, many millions. We've now been told of our five so far, they'll give us 2.5. So it's hard to say no to that, but it's a start. And then the final one that... interesting, most people, including me, didn't even know, but Kevin Brenniger brought it up in one of our first meetings, that there's still preferential treatment for smokers in the workplace in Indiana. Now that's bizarre. So we're limited as an employer of what we can do, like with difference in premium and things like that. And so we've just asked that be repealed. We're not trying to have an assault on anybody. We're just saying it just makes no sense. Especially when we're dealing with all these cost issues. So that's what we're still pushing on. And the work that we're trying to do is to show some ability to work in cooperation. You know, We've locked arms with tobacco-free kids, tobacco-free Indiana, the American Cancer Society, American Lung Association. We're not trying to take any credit. Matter of fact, we're not even trying to be in any. We're just trying to encourage people to go do things, so that we can move on to other things. And the next one is opioids. And it really concerns me. If we can't deal with the addictions related to smoking, how the heck are you going to deal with the addictions related to opioids or heroin or even worse things that are out there now? And I go back to my sister's case. She's still to this day just shakes her head, can't believe that really happened. And I still think one of the things that kept her from ever going back was that soon after she came out of recovery, she became a grandmother. And my niece told her, if I ever suspect, you'll never touch your grandchild. And you talk about sobering advice. And I looked after the conversation, I went and gave my niece a big hug. As I said, that's probably the best advice anybody could have ever given her. And my sister's a runner, and she needed to have surgery last year. And she said, there's no way. I'll deal with any pain. I don't know what's going to happen if I take something. So I'm obviously vulnerable. I can't do it. So I said, that's good. Suck it up and get tough, you know. So anyway, I do have a slide. I don't do presentations very well, and I don't think that whatever part of the brain that is. What's interesting here, though, I love this one. So on the left side, we'll tout business and all the great things that we do in the state of Indiana. Costs, taxes, regulations, infrastructure, all the things. Yay, yay, rah, rah, Indiana. And that's good stuff, and it's true. But what we don't tell the employer is the other side. But however, if you come here, there's a pretty good chance the healthiness of your employees is going to tank. I was sitting at the CICP meeting that David referenced, and a guy who runs a large publicly traded corporation elbowed me during the conversation and said, before I spoke, and said, hey, Brian, we're really supporting what you're doing. We're going to increase our premiums for smokers this year. And I whispered in his ear, I said, you can't do that in this state. And he said, what? And that's why I'm going to talk about it. So I saw him when I went up to talk. He's texting somebody. I assume it was his HR person. And I stepped back down, and he said, you're right. He said, in every other state we employ people, we do that. We can't do it here. You know, that's you can imagine, okay, here you are responsible for running this business, and somebody's telling you what your premium's going to be or what your premium can't be. It just makes no sense. It's an infringement. So all we're saying is that you need to deal with the other side of this, and we're here to help you do that. And, you know, Paul made a comment about we just opened another cancer center a week ago Monday, and, you know, it's beautiful. I mean, and if you have cancer, you know, there's all kinds of fab. We're blessed. I mean, not just the community, but if IU or St. Vincent's or St. Francis and other places, fabulous healthcare around here. I really didn't. We've had a cancer center. This is on our North Campus. We've had one there. I remember when we opened it, Susan Bai was the first lady. She cut the ribbon. So it's been a while. And I really didn't think we'd ever have to build something, because, and it's been crammed with people, because we built a new one on the south side, so that would take some demand off. We upgraded one on the east side, and that would take some demand off. We did some things in Anderson, Kokomo, and that would take some. It didn't. It's so rapid. It's so plentiful. And that's not a great feeling. I told some people recently when I was talking to the State House, I'll be glad to walk with them and put a close for business sign if we can ever get there. Because if people think we're doing these things because, you know, this is good for our business, I mean, that's just not true. But people who won't help us, I'd ask the same question of them. Because we can do things to change this. So I would ask that you go onto our website, look at the information we have. We have all kinds of flyers. But the thing is, would you at least think about, and there's scripts on there, making a one-minute call and then reaching out to the people you have influences and asking them to make a call. That's the best thing we can do. We've got 2 weeks left. We're trying to get some changes in this. And all we're asking for right now is an increase in the tax. And we pledge we're going to be right behind everybody to work with them on the cessation piece. Another person tells a story. I know I'm out of time. And one quick story I think is fascinating. Doug Leonard, who's the head of the Hospital Association, tells a story about being at a rally a few years ago down in southern Indiana. And they were talking about smoking and said they could tell that the crowd was kind of feisty. And he said, so how many of you all here are smokers? And most every hand went up. And he said, you know, so, okay, I understand that. And, you know, I realize I'm talking about something that's personal to you, but tell me how many people want your kids to be smokers? And he said every hand went down. You know, and that's what addictions is all about. You get trapped in a situation, and you figure out how to do it, and the last thing you want is to pass it on to somebody else that you care about. So our you know, top of the information you have here, you've been given this morning, you know, my request is that you do something you may have never done. Just figure out who your legislator is and give them a call and tell them what's going on. Or also on there are the names and phone numbers, everybody on the Senate Appropriations Committee, call them. Tell them, you know, just go through the script and tell them what you're trying to do, because we need to have our citizens do everything we can to have our greatest source of our greatest asset, which is our human capital, you know, be as healthy as we possibly can. So thanks, I appreciate it.
Brian, the legislature will not be able to resist that. You're going to get your way. I just know you will. That is just a hell of a talk. It's just, you are really, really good at that. And it's just inspirational to see someone, your leadership, come forward on these issues and put it into terms that everybody has to get. I'm especially really swayed by the image that you have, and I've heard you say this several times now, of people needing to stop looking down at their shoes and looking at each other and saying it's time to get something done. Do that with more legislators. I think something really good will happen. But as you say, it won't happen without a lot of people coming to the fore, calling these folks. That does work. It really does work. It's about the only thing that does work over there. And as you also suggest, there are a lot of people who are working against it for really horrible, crass motives and reasons to make that happen. So one of the things, again, that we really like about this discussion presentation today is you're hearing from people who are passionate about the problem and also determined to do something about it. And doing something in good, practical, pragmatic ways, systematic ways, and ways that can really make a difference in scale. The Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, which is critically involved in all this, Brian is also on the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation board. Obviously, the Fairbanks Foundation has had a great deal to do with putting the School of Public Health together and Paul Helverson here. This is real alliance and working together. And the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation has been working very closely with the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership and with our newest initiative, Ascend, which is dedicated to dealing with issues in the workplace around talent, around workforce, and around getting the right kinds of people in front of the right kinds of people to make opportunities happen. And the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation and Claire Fidian Green have an announcement about a new thing that can happen today that can address this problem and bring some other folks into the mix. Claire.
Well, thank you, David. Yes, I mentioned earlier that we commissioned a report that we released last year from the School of Public Health, and there were three recommendations: prevention, more harm reduction services, and growing our capacity to treat people that are addicted and who need help. So I'm very pleased to announce that our board just awarded a grant to Ascend Indiana, the Workforce Development Initiative of Central Indiana Corporate Partnership, to create a new model that's a human capital program to bring more licensed clinical social workers who are trained in substance abuse treatment into Central Indiana. It will be a partnership with Community Health Network and an education partner that has yet to be identified. After 18 months, they will launch the program, and the goal is to have 50 new licensed clinical social workers trained who can treat 3,000 more patients a year at community. And because we want the grant to be catalytic for others around the state, Ascend will also produce a report that will describe the program and provide all the research and materials that they've developed so that other providers and partners around the state can replicate it. so we can really accelerate the capacity of people trained to provide addiction treatment services around the state of Indiana. So the grant is $376,000, and I congratulate Jason and his colleague Stephanie at Ascend Indiana.
Claire, thank you very much. That's a terrific announcement. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, and let's do that as a panel. So if the three of you can come back up, we'll try to figure out how we can sit on these chairs and make this work. So we want to get to questions from the audience here, but I just have a couple of them I'd like to lead off with here just to get the conversation started. One is, so Paul, you, that slide presentation never ceases to impress of all the problems we've got.
Right.
And I know from hearing Brian talk about this in the past as well, when he came to the hospital association role, it was a target-rich environment in terms of trying to figure out which one of the many things that we're horrible at, where do you start? All of you have ended up aligning around tobacco and then opioid abuse. Why? Why those two amidst all the other, you know, again, there are probably 15 or 20 of these. So why is that?
Well, I think for me, as we look at it from a science perspective, it is the leading cause of preventable death. And it's also one that, frankly, we know how to fix this. I'm a researcher. This isn't about needing new research. We have incredible science to support the interventions that we know work, and frankly, what we need is the political will to implement it. And from a public health perspective, we know that some of the greatest advances that we've made in public health actually come at a policy level. Think about the seat belts. Think about worker safety. Think about issues around sanitation and clean water and so forth. So those aspects related to changes in policy that have the most substantial increase in improvement or change in behaviors happen at a policy level. So from my perspective, this was sort of the low-hanging fruit. And as I said earlier, we know that tobacco actually makes everything worse. People that are smoking, really, it's hard to find a disease that is made better or is left alone. It's almost always made worse by tobacco. So the fact of the matter is it has the greatest impact, there's the strongest evidence base, and frankly, it impacts all of us. So if we don't smoke, we probably know someone who smokes, we know someone who's been impacted by it. Why opioids? Well, again, for me, it's because it also is increasing in frequency and severity, and frankly, from my analogy, it's a runaway train, and it is not an issue that we know as much about by any means as we know about tobacco. We know how to deal with tobacco in just about every sphere and every aspect. But in opioids, we know that there are ways in which to impact it, but we don't know nearly as much. But what we do know is it has to do with a culture around understanding the linkage between the community and the individual. In large part, this is also related to what we call the determinants of health. You know, most of health is not really... It's not really about, and again, I admire Brian so much and our colleagues that are hospital administrators. It's not about getting better hospitals. It's not about getting better medicines. It's really about the society in which we live, issues around reducing poverty and improving jobs and employment and the hopefulness, frankly, of society. And that all sounds soft, but the reality is there's, again, strong evidence base to support that strong communities actually help improve the wellness and healthiness of the people that live in them. So
it seems to me that Indiana, we all believe in strong communities and finding ways in which to be healthy and happy and so forth. So again, to me, it seemed like an important strategy that we need to begin to work on as well. It is admittedly a longer term strategy and one in which we're going to need to try different things to see a success, but I think also equally important.
Same question for Brian and Claire for you. I mean, this all kind of fit together that way for you and that?
Yeah, when we were going through strategic planning to adopt new funding priorities at the foundation, and we worked very closely with Paul, as you can tell by the name. We provided the grant to help establish the School of Public Health, and we wanted to better understand what was going on with the people in Indiana. We looked at income, education, workforce development, and, of course, health. And we were really stunned to find out that we have one of the highest smoking rates of the 30 largest cities in the country, and that our rate is so much higher than the national average, and that it was the root cause for so many of the problems that you hear a lot about, like infant mortality, and of course our high costs. So everyone hears a lot about the opioid epidemic, which of course is tragic, and as Brian and Paul both mentioned, hits all of us. I have just as many personal stories as Brian shared, and I'm sure all of you too as well. So it is tragic, but they are very interrelated. The kinds of things that are needed, prevention, treatment, those apply across substances. We did ask Paul the question, if we could do two things to really try to make the biggest difference in health outcomes in Indiana, what should we focus on? He said, number one, tobacco, number two, opioids. So we see those as very related, and that's where the foundation is heavily concentrated to see if we can make a difference.
David, I would just add, we've got an addiction specialist at community named Dr. Tim Kelly, who I just think the world of, and he's a good friend of mine for a long time. And so we've talked about some of this, and he said, Brian, you got to understand that 100% of addicts smoke. That doesn't mean every smoker is a drug addict,
right.
But this is tied together.
So a comorbidity.
Yeah, it is.
Of all this.
And you know, one of the things that we looked at when we started getting through the data, we asked for some information to say, is this linear? If you look at rates of smoking and the rate of tax, and you do that state by state, does that equate to high rates of lung cancer, high rates of heart disease? Well, duh, it does. I mean, they're directionally relational, go state by state. I mean, they're not in exact order. They may bounce around a little bit. But when you don't tie that price to it, and so you get back to, as Paul said, this thing about being preventable. I mean, to be in healthcare, and people say, take on this whole idea of population health, which at first I thought was crazy, but I actually like that concept. Once you get that passion to do that, and you start finding things that you actually could do something
mm-hmm.
about,
mm-hmm.
you just can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Or you need to go change jobs. I mean,
right. Opening it up for questions from the audience. Yes.
My question is about so we've heard clear strategies from Paul on how to effectively economically reduce access to tobacco. Opioids, so a few months ago I had minor surgery and I was stunned how many pills I was prescribed.
Right.
Is there a strategy there to put less pills into the system?
Yes.
I have a tub at home that's full of that.
Yes. So my wife is a pharmacist actually, and so we talk about this a lot. And the reality is there's some very late-breaking research that shows that the best prescription for the most part for opioids is a 3-day supply, right? So, and it's not uncommon to see a 21-day supply, a 28-day supply. Interestingly enough, again, don't forget, it's not just physicians that are prescribing, right? We have dentists and podiatrists, and so what we need to do is focus on in our educational system what are the best practices in pain control. And what we know is that if we can reduce the number of pills that people have laying around, it's interesting the number of times that people have these pills laying around. And sometimes it's not always the case that they're the ones taking it, right? Because these pills wind up in strange places.
That's the reason why we do the drug take-back programs and so forth, because the pills wind up in the marketplace. We've even gotten to the point, interestingly enough, where we've got older people who subsidize their income by going to the doctor with what is legitimate pain and then using and then selling those drugs to others as a way to make money. We've got a mess in terms of our prescribing patterns. And so part of what needs to happen is with our providers as well. This is a problem that is not, this is like an equal opportunity offender. We're all part of the problem. So there needs to be more research in this area, but it's encouraging to know if we can reduce, the number of pills prescribed, that's one thing. Secondly, we have in this state, along with almost every state now except for one, prescription drug monitoring program, which allows us to monitor a number of prescriptions and the amount by person. So you can actually help reduce when people are drug seeking. You can find ways in which to understand that they just got three other prescriptions in the last week and hopefully curtail that. But we need to make it easier for prescribers to know that. And part of that is a technological solution. There are a lot of things happening right now. I'm really heartened by the governor's appointment of Jim McClellan as our drug czar, if you will, our director of drug work and so drug prevention and abuse. And so there are a lot of things I think that are being contemplated, but we need to move quickly to try to put some of these things in place. So there are some structural issues.
Yeah. And I would say from a health system standpoint, we now at least know, because of our electronic systems, what prescribing habits are.
Right.
We can monitor in total. We can monitor by individual. The problem, one of the problems, though, is like Paul said, is that drug seekers are pretty crafty. I told the story about taking my sister. One of the things they told us when we took her in, go home and search the house to find the rest of them. And my brother-in-law said, there's nothing else there. There was a trash bag full.
Yeah.
And so one of the problems we have, we work with John in Health Information Exchange, is trying to get the data in that exchange so that from the monitoring system so that we can see all the places they go. Because if they're just in our little network, we don't have the information we have to attack the issue. So that's one. And two, we still have trouble getting the information from the monitoring system into John's data that we all rely upon to make sure that where all these other people are going. So there's now we have a situation. We have technology out there, but we're not allowed to have it talk to each other.
Yes.
It's both and all. What we do know is that we're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. If you look at there are some people that say, well, what we need is we just need to round these people up and lock them up. Well, if you look at the number of people who have a drug problem in our prisons and jails right now, it's a majority. So we know that simply putting them in jail is not going to fix the problem. And we do need to reduce the distribution network, which I think is a law enforcement issue. But what we really need to do is to begin thinking about opioid abuse and addiction as a medical and public health issue rather than as a legal issue. So what we need is to move quickly to get people into treatment, and we need to change prescribing patterns. So it's like the old whack-a-mole, if you fix one problem, it'll begin to pop up in another. There are a multiple-pronged solution that needs to be done almost simultaneously. So we need to reduce the distribution on the street, but we also need to change the prescribing patterns. And so all of those things need to happen simultaneously.
Yeah, and I will add that it was the governor's task force, and it was codified, and Jim McClellan is leading that in his new role for Governor Holcomb. that this issue of prescribing patterns is a recognized issue not only here in Indiana but nationally.
Right.
And so steps are being taken from a policy standpoint, but it's also about implementation and how do you change individual provider practices and make sure that's all translating through entire health systems to behavior of the docs, dentists, and other prescribers as well as the patients. In the report that I mentioned that Paul and his team prepared for the foundation, there are not enough take-back places or events, so that's why a lot of these drugs are still sitting out there and people can take them, so we need to have more of things like that. If you've ever tried to return unused pills to a pharmacy, they won't take them. So making it easier to return and remove those products from the supply is pretty critical, too.
And don't flush them down the toilet, please.
Right.
It causes another problem.
John, can't
we? I think I'm trying to ask a precision medicine question. We're at the point in precision medicine that we can, through genetic screening, see who will respond better to, like, cancer medication. And there's certainly different rates at which opioids are metabolized.
Right.
Has anybody looked at whether there's a genetic predisposition for becoming addicted to opioids?
You want to take that?
Well, precision medicine, I'm not the authority. But I can only tell you what people have told me when I've had these conversations with our physicians is that because of the lack of information, I don't think people were giving hordes of pills because they were trying to get somebody addicted. If you go back and look at some of the research, I mean, you know, and Paul can talk to this better than I can, but what I read says people thought that the oxycodone wasn't addictive. It was marketed as not being addictive. Well, how wrong was that?
Yeah.
And so that fueled a lot of what's here, and that whole story of that is just a real perplexing thing. So then you get to something that you have so much quantity that if you're not self-regulating, but you have pain. So, you know, I believe that, I personally believe that based upon the habits we've had in the past, that only somebody's willpower keeps them from being addicted. I think they're more likely to become addicted. And so that's why we've got to put in place methodologies and use the tools we have to monitor this to help people. Because on their own, for a lot of reasons, and back to the point of it becoming currency. When all of a sudden those pills are currency, now we got a whole other issue. But I know, you know, I talk to kids in high schools, and they tell me in many different places that, you know, you can get heroin in seconds. For cheap, and it's cheap. And it's cheaper than cigarettes.
There is emerging research on this area, though, and there are a number of scientists in the room that I recognize that could probably speak better about it, but... the reality is that we do know so much more about our genetic makeup and its impact on how we respond to a whole variety of things. So.
Other questions? Yes.
Overdose deaths, and we're not also looking at illicit drugs.
Paul mentioned that it is a very complex challenge, and it's multi-sector. So certainly criminal justice plays a role, child welfare, health systems, employers, we all have to be involved. And that's why we need to do a much better job, much more quickly and comprehensively on prevention, number one, because you're right, just because you're addicted to opioids and your supply of pills gets cut off doesn't mean you can't go get much cheaper heroin very easily. So there's that issue of prevention. And that grant that I just announced, there is a capacity gap in terms of supply of providers trained in addictions. So we need to do a much better job training the supply coming out of schools of medicine and schools of nursing, et cetera. But we really need to rapidly grow that supply who can do the addictions counseling so we can tackle it in a comprehensive way.
I would just say two things, Gloria. One is that when you live in the crossroads of America, it gets distributed through the state pretty readily.
Mm-hmm.
We're set up to distribute good things and bad things related to that. And the second thing is on the supply piece, we've got a unit that we've actually are ready to open, add more capacity. We don't have workers. I mean, we can't do it. So when it's time to find people, and it's a high rate of turnover. I mean, you know, so there's a lot that needs to happen to increase the supply. I'm only talking about one place, but this has got to be a group effort. And the heroin piece of it is very, very plentiful from those patients that end up in our organization.
And I would just add, and I'm so appreciative of you bringing up this issue, because it's amazing the number of people that I talk to that about the opioid issue, and they say, you know what, those people ought to just quit that. Just quit. I mean, stop. Those people should stop. The reality is, as you know, they're addicted. This is a chemical addiction. The body needs that drug to be able to survive. In fact, when you talk to addicts, they'll tell you they cannot imagine living beyond to the next hour without that drug. And the same thing, frankly, and although it's not exactly the same thing by any means, but this addiction power of tobacco is also strong. So that idea of saying to people, just quit that, is really kind of a fantasy. And we know a lot about addiction on the basis of the physiological and psychological dependence. So I think what we need to be sensitive to is that there is a good addiction science that's out there. There are ways in which we can help people quit. And simply telling people to quit is like asking someone to fly to the moon. It's without a rocket ship. So the idea is that we need to focus on good science and evidence-based approaches to treatment that will allow people to successfully withdraw from their addiction and move towards something that brings them away from that. And to the point that Claire made, we have a substantial shortage of medication-assisted treatment in our state. We have a shortage of treatment beds, particularly for public patients that don't have access to coverage. So there's a lot of issues that we need to begin to address all at the same time.
Claire, a quick question for you on the grant. Probably something I should be asking Jason as well, but you mentioned that this is with community and with an education provider yet to be determined.
Correct.
Are there best practices or best curricula out there that people are looking at for what that program ought to be in terms
that,
of what the
you'll
what,
have to ask Jason about that. I do know that they already have a partnership with community to grow the supply of nursing. So it's an employer-led nursing training program. So that's a great template for this, is that the employer says, here's the demand that I can't meet because we can't find skilled workforce, so we're going to design a program that will produce the supply that we need in this needed area. And so part of that is going to be finding if such a curricula exists and if not, developing it.
And clearly the goal would be to produce 3,000, but obviously that's scalable. Once some of this gets figured out, it ought to be scalable.
That's correct. That was important to our board, is that mm-hmm. it wasn't just a benefit for community, which, of course, is very important because Barry Central Indiana's largest providers of behavioral health, but that it could be a scalable solution for other providers across the state.
Right. Yes.
Is the four-step program that you outlined, Brian, related to tobacco, has anybody done any work in trying to understand how far and how fast all four of those pieces of the program? Is this a quick fix? Is it a medium-term fix? Is it a very
what's the outcome going to be when we do those?
I'll give you my sense, and Paul has some more research on it. But I mean, it's a time. I mean, this is not a, everybody's not smoking tomorrow. So it does occur over time. We thought it was especially important to have all four, and we really thought that you know, you really need to take all four. You should not bifurcate this. You're limiting your chances of success with this. That hadn't lasted very well at this point, but that's fine. But we will see a decline in rate, but we also know that, you know, quitting's hard. So just because somebody goes through a cessation program doesn't mean they're going to quit. So there's a lot of resources that's going to be provided there. But I believe that's why the Tobacco 21, that's the major thing in all of this. Only two states have done it. A bunch of cities have done it, though.
Yeah, over 100.
You know, so it's really interesting. You know, how people kind of bought on and said, this is what we ought to be doing. That's still, if I only had one, that's what it would be. But it's also the most difficult. Only two states are California and Hawaii, which doesn't give us much credibility sitting in the Midwest.
I think there's two answers. One is individually. We know that even within 30 days of a smoker quitting, they'll begin to see demonstrable health effects. So even someone that's smoked all their life will have an impact, an improvement in their quality of life and reduction in disease risk factors as early as 30 days after they quit, and substantial benefits within a year. If you look at those states that have had a substantial increase in their tax, they've seen very significant reductions in tobacco use within that year. And certainly within the second year. So if you did all four, and I don't know that any state has actually done all four in the way that we were describing, I think it has the greatest opportunity for success. And I would be shocked if we didn't see just a very, very substantial change. Again, they're taken together in good purpose because the Tobacco 21 is the greatest long-term benefit. The tobacco tax is the greatest short-term benefit. And then the staffing and the tobacco cessation product. You know, the CDC recommends, based upon our population in Indiana, we should be spending around $73.8 million a year in tobacco prevention and cessation. There's evidence-based strategies on how to spend that money. And it goes the gamut of all different kinds of things. And we spend $5 million. And then we wonder, and we also have one of the lowest tobacco taxes, and then we wonder why we have a problem. Well, we shouldn't wonder anymore. We ought to be intellectually honest enough to say we know what we're doing and we are not choosing to deal with this problem.
I'm going to squeeze in. You were patient, so one last question. You got it.
Red Bull.
They can walk 20 feet in a straight line, but they don't realize that they have the dependency that they have to have that much alcohol in their body and caffeine at the same time to function. So they are the future addicts of the society. So I hear all the programs for the full-blown addicts, but not for the future. Who will become into that population? You know, who will go into that population? So. Are there any
programs? Is there a pre-addiction versus addiction?
Well, we know that education can have an impact, and I think the greatest impact on pre-addiction is helping people to understand the impact of those substances on their body and being able to make more informed choices. Again, people, I don't believe, want to make bad choices. They don't think about it, right? So being able to create and provide both two things. One is we need to provide them with the education to make good choices. But then secondly, we need to make the norm, the healthy choice, the default choice. So by changing the norms and policies and laws so that we actually can prevent things by promoting the healthy choice as the default choice, we know that that will change behavior. There's a whole area called behavioral economics that actually begins to, it's a very rational way in which to approach changing incentives to improve and encourage health. And that's what we need to do.
And at that, I think we're at our time. Thanks again very much to Claire, to Paul, and to Brian. Each of them mentioned that their slides are available. All the slides will also be available on the BioCrossroads and BioIntellects websites in about a day or two, I think, as well as a podcast from today's session. So check that. Again, it's www.biointellects.com or www.biocrossroads.com will get you there. And we, again, want to thank Miles Printing. We want to thank all of you for coming. Our next session will be on May 2nd. It will be presented in conjunction with Roche Diagnostics on diagnostics. So we look forward to seeing you then. Have a great day, and thanks again for a terrific discussion.